You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
And welcome into a Wednesday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. As always, I'm your host, Gavin Shaw. Joining me, just 20 to 30 blocks to my north, the Joshua Bass. And Josh is trying to find you some new roommates tonight. I know you're going to eventually leave the nest before
me. I don't appreciate this. What's going on with this?
Yeah. Oh, what, the roommates? You don't want new roommates?
I mean, I have people in mind that I will be reaching out to accordingly, and I don't need your outreach for this. It's like you're trying to prostitute me.
No. I just, come on. You're a valuable commodity on the open market. We both know that. You're a funny guy. You're nice. You're clean. You're successful. And I just really want to get the most for that value. Let's sell you at a good price.
You're trying to Joe Harris me?
Yeah. I'm trying to Joe Harris you. That's a beautiful transition into perhaps Joe Harris's best game of this Nets season. 19 points on 10 shots with no free throws. I can't imagine more than five or six guys have accomplished that type of efficiency this year. 5 of 5 from beyond the arc. We will get more into him. But first, Josh, I want to talk about the end of this Thunder game. If I have it right, box score just went down. Nets finishing this one up a 109-108 loss to the Oklahoma City Thunder. And it was another case of second game in a row. They were up by as many as 15 points, and then twice this game and against the Detroit Pistons, they totally blow that lead, and then both times it comes down to a Spencer Dinwiddie shot in the closing seconds. He made it against Detroit. He made one with 13 seconds left against the Thunder, but it was not enough as Russell Westbrook answered, and then he could not hit over his college teammate Andre Roberson, and the Nets fell in this one. I'm kind of interesting because the last few games, or really maybe the 10 or even 20 before this, we were talking about how the Nets would get into these big deficits and have rapid comebacks, and now it's like they don't know how to handle being ahead against a good team.
Yeah, I mean, it was honestly surprising. Once they took the big lead at the end of the second quarter, I kept waiting for it to get gradually chipped away, and it did, but then the Nets were able to come back in the middle of the third quarter, extend the lead back out to 10 to 12, and then until Raymond Felton really made his run, which I never thought I would say that. And then from there on, it was a close game. But the Nets did a good job of keeping the Thunder at bay, I thought.
Can you believe, because in like pre like 1990, I'd say even pre 2000, like a really good NBA player, like a guy who was like a perennial all-star, like he played 10 years in the NBA, and that would be like a really, really good career. Raymond Felton, who peaked as like probably like a slightly above average starter, has been in the league for 13 seasons. That's insane to me. Like Ian pointed that out on the broadcast, and like I realize it's right because he's on the 04 Carolina team, but that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, like one of the first like college teams I really remembered vividly. Obviously, Felton, Rashad McCants, big Sean May inside. Yeah. But I don't know, Felton. He's just like so out of shape, also, and like, I don't understand how he's still playing. It's really incredible to watch.
Yeah, and now they put him.
Is he the most out of shape player in the league?
That's a good question. I don't know. I guess Boris Diaw's out of the NBA now, so maybe he's certainly a candidate. And the fact that like now he's in like probably like one of the barbecue capitals of the world. Like I know Oklahoma City isn't with there with like Texas and like the Carolinas and Kansas City, but like they have some good barbecue in Oklahoma City. So I'm surprised he's gotten through that okay. But you mentioned it. He scored 10 points in a row, two threes, a jumper, and then I think he had like a little floater to cap it off to get Oklahoma City right back in this one after they had fought back previously with a 12-0 run in the third quarter. And then to me, what was kind of the sequence of the game from the Nets side of things when it looked like they were going to give up another game and like maybe like the Thunder would like turn around and run away with this game that the Nets had total control of. They put in this young lineup of D'Angelo Russell, Caris LeVert, Joe Harris, Jared Allen. I think Quincy AC was also in there, but he doesn't really fit the narrative, so we're not going to mention him. And that unit just got me so hyped, Josh. Like I was more enthusiastic about that 5-minute stretch of basketball this year than maybe anything I've seen from the Nets all season, just because it so clearly represented their future, with I think all four of those guys being under 25, everyone other than Joe Harris being 24, 23 or younger. Allen did a great job like kind of rebounding and like controlling the game defensively for that stretch. Obviously, he also had the block on Russ towards the end of the game. It was generally great protecting the rim, but it was really Caris LeVert kind of dictating that 9-0 run. He had a old-fashioned and one, and then he hit Joe Harris for a three on a play where D'Angelo Russell, and we're going to get into his play a little bit more, set a really nice drag screen for Joe Harris. And like D'Angelo Russell, like a guy who I think is clearly making an effort to his teammates to prove that he can fit in with the relative success they had while he's out. That's kind of the epitome of those efforts. Like the guy who's allegedly your star player, who's been called selfish in the past, setting a screen in transition for a guy like Joe Harris, who's a career journeyman. Harris hitting every three on the night, drained it. And then D'Lo comes back down, couldn't get a shot going for three games in a row, and he hits a massive three. That run to me just I don't know, it got me going, Josh, and I'm assuming you felt the same way.
Evan, the juices were flowing during that run. I mean, it was incredible. You're seeing all these the young guys that the Nets are hyping up, and to see them deliver in one of the biggest stages against Russell Westbrook, Carmelo Anthony, Paul George. I mean, these are guys that, I guess definitely Russ's case, Melo maybe, Paul George. I mean, Hall of Famers. I wouldn't go that far for Paul George and Melo, but still perennial All Stars and big names in this league, and the Nets were going toe to toe against them.
I hate to break it to you, Josh, but I think Melo's going to be a Hall of Famer. But we'll see.
Yeah, no, I think he's kind of in that Dwight Howard class for me, where I think they should be Hall of Famers, but they have such backlash against them that I'm not sure what will happen. But I feel like Melo gets more respect.
Yeah, 100%.
And from fans, just because he gets buckets.
I think I know hardcore analysts and purists, which I occasionally consider myself in that group, rail against the way Melo's played his whole career, and we don't have to go too far down this rabbit hole, but I don't know. I'd agree with that. I think Dwight, amongst people, even though at his peak, I'd say he was a better player than Carmelo Anthony, is kind of a joke. And Melo, I think, is by people who really, really know basketball, even the people like me who love unselfishness and know Melo was never that. I think they really they just know that he was a killer at his peak, and he still has a little bit of that in him.
Yeah, I mean, I was never a big Melo fan, but I definitely appreciate how good he was in his prime.
Yeah, and the cool thing about Carmelo Anthony now is he's not really as hyped as he used to be, which means you can get him at a better price when you play Daily Fantasy. And that's why I'm calling all fantasy sports fans to listen up. Did you know that your chances of winning on draft are 80% better than on salary cap sites? That's why Draft is my favorite fantasy site. No more getting crushed by the pros. And it's not just me. More than 1 million people have already downloaded Draft and are enjoying it too. Play in a real live NBA draft right now. Be done in under 5 minutes and get paid out the next day. Drafts are filling every second, so you can join one whenever you want. All new players get a free entry into a real money draft when you make your first deposit, but you have to use my promo code LONBA. That's right, play in a real money draft for free just by using my promo code LONBA. But it gets even better. Draft is so sure you'll love it that they're even offering Locked On Nets listeners a money-back guarantee up to $100. Just search Draft in the App Store or go to draft.com and come play free right now with the promo code one more time, LONBA. Josh, I want to take a few seconds and let's talk about D'Angelo Russell a little bit more. I don't know. I still continue to think, this is so weird because I was totally on the opposite side of things when he was first coming back. I think at this point, he can afford to be a little bit more aggressive and searching for his own shot. And then that's not necessarily taking contested threes, but attacking the basket. And he has attacked, but when he has, he's done it to pass, which I like, but he has to kind of refine that balance. And it's just so clear to me, he's not totally playing with that same confidence. And he's clearly not the same guy. Like one time he tried to go one-on-one with Patrick Patterson, and Patterson, who's not exactly a dynamic one-on-one defender, just flat out stripped him. But even with all that, I think it's so obvious that when he's in, he raises the bench's ceiling quite a bit. Because before, you knew exactly what you were getting. It was either Stauskas or Harris hitting threes. And if you could stop Karras from attacking, you were going to shut down the Nets bench. And now they are really versatile. And all of a sudden, when things are clicking, it looks like you have a really talented team.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a good point, because Karras was having to create everything with the second unit when D'Lo was out, but D'Lo really takes some of the pressure off him, took 6 shots in 15 minutes. And even though he's still struggling getting some of his explosiveness back, you obviously mentioned the time he couldn't get past Pat, I mean, he wasn't an explosive player to begin with. So obviously any sort of injury is going to be concerning because you can't lose any step at all. But he definitely is able to create shots for his teammates and others. 4 assists last night. I think they were a plus 12 with him on the court, made that big run in the third quarter with him out there. So it's good to see him kind of getting in the flow of things. And I'm honestly surprised how much usage he had, considering that I kind of forgot he was out there when he was on the floor.
Yeah, he jacked like quite a few shots, but I don't know. I was generally I'm pretty happy with how he played. And like if the shots start falling again, like all of a sudden, like this is a Nets team that went toe to toe with the Thunder, and if he can,
yeah, and we beat the Thunder in the Mexico City game,
right? So. Right. I mean, in that time, there's no Paul George, but the Nets obviously didn't have D'Lo, and Paul.
But just
George,
wait, can I make a quick comment?
Yeah, go
Nets
ahead.
Have always had good success against the Thunder going back the last few years. I think they won maybe 2 years ago. Someone hit a buzzer beater. Was it Joe Johnson? But it was one of these years where they had like maybe 28 wins 2 years ago. And they were still able to beat the Thunder. So they've had pretty good success against them.
Yeah, yeah. And then again, 2 games in a row, they played them exceptionally well. And once again, in this one, up by 15, not quite able to finish it off. I want to talk about that end of game sequence, Josh, but I wanted to quickly put up a, not really an advertisement, but an endorsement of the podcast. Our boss, David Locke, just did with Sports Illustrated's Ben Golliver. They had a really fascinating conversation on just like the most absurd stuff going on in the NBA right now. And they did like a 10-15 minute breakdown of all the Cavs drama. And when you just like really like put it in perspective, like how kind of destructive and weird everything that's going on with Cleveland is, it brought me to a question, Josh. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this because I know we both want to go to sleep, but what do you think about this hypothetical? Would you rather have the Nets or Cavs roster, front office, future draft picks? Like basically, like which team would you take going forward over the next 10 years? And I guess that would like largely rest on like whether or not you think LeBron is coming back. But right now, like, and this sounds amazing to say because I never ever would have said it before the season, Brooklyn's future feels like a lot more secure than Cleveland's does.
So yeah, I think that you're getting a little crazy on me, Gavin.
Okay, that's fair.
Because the Nets' future might be more secure. We know they have a plan in place, but a lot of things have to hit right. I mean, guys like Jared Allen and Caris LeVert have to become above average starters. I feel like just having LeBron, it gives such a high ceiling to your future. And even if LeBron leaves, you're going to be terrible. You have the Nets pick this year. That's a bunch of lottery balls right now, and with the infrastructure that the Nets have in place, they're never going to be that bad to tank. So I think that they really are counting on these mid-level prospects panning out. And have we seen something from D'Angelo Russell that's going to say he's surefire going to be an all-star? I don't know if we can say that right now.
Yeah, no, it really is an interesting conversation, and it's a lesson like in not overreacting to one game or a few games, which I know I've a tendency to do, and I've proven a few times out on this podcast. But again, like the reason like I came up with that question, and like even, and you can make an argument that it is a little ridiculous just because one team has LeBron James and one team's best player is arguably Spencer Dinwiddie. But when everything clicks like it did tonight, and you see like the ceiling of those guys, like I don't know, like I just see the best in some of these players, and I see Caris as a guy who's like a borderline star with his explosiveness and his vision. And just some of the sheer passing, and like again the way he just, as you said it, in a game that Russell Westbrook, Carmelo Anthony, and Paul George were in, just for small stretches he was the guy controlling the action on the floor. So just little flashes like that, and some guys like can never capture that and can never translate that over a long period of time. So there's still a lot of questions to how that pans out, but you just see those little flashes, and you see Joe Harris shooting the ball like this, and just with his smarts and strength and touch. You see a guy who could legitimately turn into one of the best role players in the NBA. And after watching him all this year, and again, it's easy to react and overreact in a month where he's shooting 50% from three, but I really do see that as the upside for him. And you see like a third guy in D'Lo who, if nothing else, is just a really smart passer and scorer. And then you see a guy in Jared Allen who, and I want to get into how he played and what you thought about his performance after this, who again, like one of the Nets' like bigger, higher profile opponents this season, and one of the louder venues they're going to play in all year. And he's going toe-to-toe with, like, the Incredible Hulk in Steven Adams and, like, getting rebounds, like, blocking Russell Westbrook at the rim, confidently like making moves in the lane. Like you just see the flashes from all these guys, and it really does like give me a lot of confidence that the Nets could kind of build through the middle, which I think, as you really astutely pointed out, isn't typically an avenue for building a championship team in the NBA. And I'm not saying the Nets are that or are ever going to be that, but you just see the potential for something special out of guys who weren't regarded that way coming out of school.
No, I mean, I certainly agree with you. They're making highlight level plays, but it's about consistency. And Jared Allen, he's been trending the right direction the entire season. Kevin was great up, but now since he's come back in January, he's shooting 30% from the field, under 30% from three. He's really struggling with his shot. I don't know if there's anyone that has a clear path to being a high level starter on this team.
Yeah, and you gotta, I don't know. I mean, you gotta
you definitely see the flashes, and it's great to see, but if it only happens once every three games, I mean, I value the other two more than the third when it happens.
No, that's 100% fair, and I guess that's probably the right way to look at it. But again, like it's on like the other like variable here is their age, and like because of that, like I kind of treat those things on a sliding scale. And I think with younger guys, it's sometimes reasonable to like value the flashes even if they're more infrequent than the inconsistency and the occasional poor shooting. So it's two different approaches.
Nets hasn't seen a lot of prospects not pan out. I mean, guys like Marshawn Brooks, I know he got traded, so that might be a bit of a different example. But even Marcus Williams, Sean Williams, guys that showed a lot of flashes in their rookie seasons and people were hyping up as guys that could be top contributors down the line and starter level players, and they just flamed out. So I don't like to get too excited over any prospects. That's not really a sure thing. Like
Lopez
in his rookie season, I saw something where I said, okay, this guy is going to be a high-level starter for a long time. And then by year two, he was averaging 18 points and 8 rebounds a game.
Right, and that's the thing, and they gotta keep building on it. And like I don't know, I guess we kind of dovetailed into this conversation, but I mean, I guess what you put your faith in, if that's your consideration, is just like how hard these guys work. And I remember like on the broadcast, there was a whole anecdote about Caris LeVert being like so clearly the hardest working guy on the team, like in the gym for the Nets, like literally every single day of the summer, and just like little things like that, like those are that's the effort and the work are like kind of the variables that can tip those guys one way or another, that like so clearly, like LeVert, like Allen, have just immense natural ability. But that's we can dive down that road deeper on other podcasts, and I'm sure we'll continue to I guess we kind of got enough on Allen there. Unless did you have any additional thoughts on how he played? If not, we can kind of go to like the final minutes. And
I thought him even just taking the three, not alone making it, was such a great sign for his confidence. Like, I mean, I think he's only taken 7 threes this entire season, and I think the first 4 or 5 of those were by at least the end of November. And a lot of times he would be open in the corner and just shy away from taking it. And I know the shot clock was winding down when Ronda Hollis-Jefferson passed it to him, but great sign to see him take it with confidence as opposed to dribble around and look for a handoff. So I thought that was really encouraging.
Yeah, that was with just over 3 minutes left, and they were down 98-101. And yeah, that was, I mean, like there was a reason the Thunder left him wide open. They didn't see like any scenario where he shot that, and he just comes up, coolly drains it, finishes this game 12 points on 6 shots, 11 rebounds, superb outing for him. Yeah. And again, the biggest thing for me was like the rim protection. Like there were a few times where like Russ got him, but like there were times like outside of the block, like 2 or 3 different possessions where like he flat out like made Russell Westbrook like miss the shot at the rim. And that's like, I mean, for guys other than LeBron, like probably like the best finisher in the league. So that's
right. Like when you, like he has a good job of like coming over to contest and using his length, but sorry, I was watching RHJ highlights.
there's like heavy breathing there for a second. Right, I'm gonna leave that in there.
Those are my Dinwiddie highlights. Gavin.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
but when Allen's kind of standing at the rim flat-footed, there he really needs to add a lot of strength, because there are times when offensive player can just run into him and just bully him over, and then have a clear layup. So that's really what he needs to work on, but he is a good positional defender, understands angles well, wants to be in the right position, so I think he's going to figure it out.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. Like, I think, like, the frame and the instincts are there, and, like, if he can build on both of those things, like, just by, like, adding knowledge over time in the league, and, like, obviously he's gonna put a lot of work into his body, and, like, he questioned, like, kind of, like, Kristaps Porzingis, like, how much could he how much weight could he feasibly put on? How much muscle could he feasibly put on? But if he had just enough to get like a little bit more core strength and a little bit stronger, I think that could really tilt and he could be someone again like that. That's the kind of guy who changes your franchise if you get that dominant rim protector. So hopefully for the Nets' sake, that's what he'll end up being down the road. All right, final few minutes of this one. I just want to talk about those last few possessions. Like I think it's worth noting, like Dinwiddie, who coming into this game led the NBA in made shots in the final 15 seconds. I think he also led the league in attempts. Got another one in the final 13. He was guarded by Russell Westbrook initially, and I was like, and this is like such an indictment on Russ on this play, Josh. Like I don't know. Maybe you noticed this too. But what happened was Damari Carroll came over to set a screen, and like it really wasn't like a good screen. Like Russ, like with his athleticism and footwork, like he could have fought right through it and stuck right with Dinwiddie. And again, with his speed and strength, made it really hard for Dinwiddie to get right to the rim. But instead, Russ like just totally died on the screen. And again, this wasn't like middle of the second quarter. This is with 13 seconds left in the game, and you're up one. He just totally dies and leaves Carmelo Anthony on an island with Dinwiddie, which was easy money. Dinwiddie gets there, ducks his college teammate Andre Roberson and the brother of his girlfriend, and he gets that athletic finish at the rim. So I was stunned by how lazy Russ was on that play. Like even though it was an incredible finish for Dinwiddie, but that was kind of my biggest takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The process was good because Dinwiddie still had a really tough finish that he needed to execute. So maybe if Russ has to get over the screen, they don't switch. He has a clear path to the lane. So we don't really know what would have happened, but I do agree with you that Russ's effort on defense is pretty subpar, even at the end of games. Also, what about Dinwiddie drawing the illegal screen on Paul George that wasn't called?
I don't even remember that. When was that?
Are you kidding me? So the last play when Russ scored the basket, Paul George inbounds the ball.
Oh, yeah, the screen. Yeah.
And shoves Dinwiddie out of the way. What was that?
Yeah, it was weird. Like, you know, like it was like kind of like in like the back of the place. Like, I can't even say like I looked at it that much, but like I know they made like – like is like kind of like an Iron Eagle, like being like very like apolitical and like not wanting to make a big issue of it. But he did mention he's like yeah, that was a tough great screen by George on the backside.
As soon as I saw that, I immediately I looked on Twitter for the results for Paul George screen just to see how everyone agreed with me and we could all take solace in the fact as Nets fans that we're screwed again.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say, like, just in general, like, the Nets, like, I think rightly have, like, a lot, like, I think, like, I don't want to say, like, officiating's turn games. There's a lot of times, like, whether early in games or letting teams come back, they've kind of dug their own graves and they put themselves in a position to get screwed over by officials, but it's happened quite a few times this year. And then Josh, here's another one that you might not have caught. Earlier in the game, like, in the first half specifically, Dinwiddie had what should have been an and one because he got fouled and put up a shot that got goaltended off the side of the backboard, and they didn't call it even though it was clearly touched on the backboard, and that ended up costing the Nets a point that theoretically could have tied it at the end. And then they gave a really like freakish, like shouldn't have happened, like buzzer beater on like a rebound to Steven Adams to end the half. That was
there's two buzzer beaters in a row because Paul George also hit a shot with maybe 1 second left in the first quarter. So bad end of quarter defense.
Yeah, and that like obviously like I'm really being a hypocrite because I usually hate when analysts reference that stuff because like it's totally like a butterfly effect scenario where a million different things would have happened if those shots hadn't gone in and you have no idea how the rest of the game goes. But if you want to look at it in terms of raw math, those two plays also cost the Nets. And then I don't know. I wasn't like really happy with the defense like Carroll played on the switch like onto Russ at the end of the game. Like obviously like Carroll isn't quick enough to guard Russ, but like if you're on him in that situation, you're like a wily veteran defender like Carroll. Like shouldn't you know that like you're doing every single thing you can to force Russ to the middle, and maybe like Russ gets to the middle and then just does like an up and under around Allen. But because like Carroll just like essentially like gave Russ like the lane going right, like Allen didn't even have a chance to contest that shot.
Yeah, that whole possession was kind of a mess. I mean, yeah, Allen, I don't know. I thought he did a decent job there. Russ kind of threw it hard off the backboard and just kind of sat on the front of the rim and just died in.
Well, like Allen did, I'm saying like, I think Allen made a good play on it.
Yeah.
But like if Carroll hedges middle, like Allen can get his full body in front of Russ, and like maybe Russ finishes like through him, around him, or over him. But that's definitely like a tougher play in that scenario.
Yeah. I mean, it's also tough because since Dinwiddie was illegally screened, like Carroll had to sub in momentarily, and also I can't really blame anyone for not forcing Russell Westbrook to the middle because as we talked about last episode, he is just a superhuman athlete.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And he like threw like a little hesitation move at Carroll, and that's probably like what got him.
And also going back to your point with the refs, I mean, I don't think it's malicious that they've been screwing the Nets over more often than you'd like. I mean, I just think it's happened, and unfortunately, that's the way it goes. And I think the best thing the Nets can do is not continue to gripe and complain about the refs, because it's just gonna lead to more tension between them and the officials.
Yeah, it's the same thing with the Clippers, who like sort of had credibility because they had two stars, and like over time you could tell they just like had like a toxic relationship, and like the Nets, I don't think they want to really establish that rep. And then, all right, we'll end it here. Last play of the game. I don't know. I don't think there was really anything they could have done better, especially like going up against the defense with like Adams, Roberson, and Paul George. Like, there's so much athleticism on the floor. Like, you can't really like run a set that involves like a pass with 3 seconds left, because they're going to just cover so much ground and so much length. So I think that Dinwiddie step back, even though it looked ugly, and like especially going against, like,
I thought it went in. Did you think?
I did. I knew it didn't, just because I was rewatching it. But yeah, I kind of did too, because it looked like it was like it went up so quickly. It was like one of those like shots that's so ugly, it looked like it went off the backboard and like banked in. Yeah, no, I 100% saw that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, because same with you. I couldn't watch the game live. I knew the Nets had lost, and I was just like, wait, did we win? What happened? Like, was it wrong?
Would you have called ESPN if you like looked at the replay and like really thought it went in? You'd be like, hey, we gotta fix this.
I was at a Washington Nets Wizards game in Washington, sitting behind the basket, and Darren Williams,
the legend,
net.
Pariah,
probably my least favorite player of all time. Just an absolute terrible Nets Hall of Shame. He took a three that we thought all went in. I was sitting with two of my friends, and all three of us thought it went in. And we're just like, they're not counting it on the scoreboard. What's happening? And then I was tweeting at some of the beat writers at the time, like Tim Bontemps, like, what happened to D Will's three? It went in. They said it didn't. And then I find out later when I was watching the replay that it was an air ball.
Yeah, it was kind of like the I already told you, I was at the Knicks game a few weeks ago when they played the Spurs, and Manu like the pass that just went in, and it was
weird. But everyone knew that it went in, besides
I know watching on TV everyone did, but I'm telling you, every single person in the arena, even the Spurs fans, nobody thought it went in.
Because Michael Beasley started dribbling.
Yeah, it was his smart. Like, if Pop hadn't like basically run out to midcourt and like screamed at them, like I don't know if they would have like figured it out eventually, but like it would have been like a quarter before they'd gone back and reviewed it and added it. It was like, I've never seen anything like it. All right. Yeah. Anyways, Josh, that was a great, like, we finally got one in under 30 minutes and still packed a ton of content in it. So I'm really thrilled with this episode of the Locked On Nets podcast. We'll probably be back on Saturday for the breakdown of the Nets' next game against the Milwaukee Bucks. Unless, am I missing one in the middle? I don't think they play again before Friday. All right. Let's assume I'm right. Anyways, Josh, thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We will be back then. Peace out.